Hello, welcome to Hope Church Harrogate's Message of the Week. If you'd like to connect with us, please head over to hopeharrogate.co.uk/connect. We'd love to hear from you.
Dan is coming up to preach in a moment, but before he does that, I'm just going to read you the scripture from today. So we are in 1 Corinthians 8. Now, about food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all possess knowledge. But knowledge puffs up, while love builds up. Those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know. But whoever loves God is known by God. So then, about eating food sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things came and for whom we live. There is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live. But not everyone possesses this knowledge. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat sacrificial food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to a god. And since their conscience is weak, it is defiled. But food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat and no better if we do. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your rights does not become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone with a weak conscience sees you with all your knowledge eating in an idol's temple, won't that person be emboldened to eat what is sacrificed to idols? So, this weak brother or sister for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. So when you sin against them in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother or sister to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause them to fall. Let's welcome Dan.
Thank you very much. Can you all hear me? Very good. So, this is our series on 1 Corinthians. We are looking at how the Corinthians were called to be part of the world, but different from the world. They were to be seen by those around them as distinct from them in some very important ways. And this week's particular talk, we are focused on making good decisions. So it's about how do we work out what is the right thing? It's ethics and morality as a big concept. How do we know what the right thing to do is in any given moment? And the particular context that the Corinthians were looking at this in was idol food, which I don't know if you've ever struggled with this issue yourself. I have to say I haven't, but we can still learn plenty from it. For once, Paul's argument seems pretty clear to follow. You can actually see that some people think it's okay, some people think it's not, and the ones that think it's okay, if they do it with the ones that who don't, then they affect them, and that's bad. We kind of can understand this. But we have to still read between the lines a bit, because this is, although it's 1 Corinthians, it wasn't the first letter that went between Paul and the Corinthians. We start by saying, now about idol food. He's clearly responding to a question that the Corinthians have asked him. Interestingly, 2 Corinthians is not the next letter either, because we see in 2 Corinthians, he says, now what you wrote to me in your earlier letter, and the thing that he writes about isn't in 1 Corinthians. So there were several letters, and this is just one part of the conversation. So we can kind of read between the lines and work out what the Corinthians' question to Paul was. And they are asking, can we eat food that has been sacrificed to idols? And that kind of comes in two flavors, if you like, pun completely intended. There is food which is sacrificed in the temple, and then they have this big feast, and it's a big party, it's a big social occasion. It's like the ancient Near Eastern equivalent of a restaurant. Everyone goes together, have a great time, and that food is eaten there by everyone who's worshipping. And then some of the meat would also go to the priests, and it would be their food to eat. And some of the meat would be sold in the market afterwards, because if you sacrifice a big animal, that's quite a lot of meat, and it's not all going to get eaten in one go. Presumably they're raising money for the Temple of Zeus or whoever it is. And so can we eat the meat in the temples, and can we eat the meat sold in the markets? These are two separate questions. And it would have been part of normal life for this everyone in this church before they came to know Jesus, before Paul gave them the good news of the gospel. They would have all done this as part of a weekly rhythm, maybe, and it would have just been part and parcel of normal life. And so it was quite a big deal for them to step away from that. And their argument, where they seem to say, we think we can, seems to be in response to Paul having already said, don't do it. And they come with four key arguments as to why they think, actually, Paul, we think we should be able to do it. Here's the reasons why. And their four arguments are, we all possess knowledge. We all possess knowledge. And that knowledge is that idols are just lumps of metal and wood. They don't really mean anything. They can't do anything. So what does it matter? Their second argument is food for the stomach and the stomach for food. And we saw Paul debate this point when it came to the sexual ethics and talking about actually what we do with our bodies really does matter. But food's for the stomach, the stomach's for food. This is food. I've got a stomach. So where should the food go? In my stomach. Third point, we've all been baptized. We've all got the Spirit. We're protected. What could go wrong? And their fourth point is, you, Paul, you eat idol food. We've seen you do it. And so Paul's response will cover the next three chapters. So be ready for this to come up again and again throughout June and July. We're going to spend a while seeing Paul's response to this. The point about the baptism comes up in chapter 10. I'm not going to talk about that much today. The point about Paul responding to how he deals with this personally himself is all in chapter 9. So I'm really looking at the first two points and how Paul responds in this chapter to those two points. And his response here is not unique. Almost identical passage is in Romans 14 and 15, and he unpacks it a bit more and is a bit more explicit. That's a much later letter. So clearly, this problem was not unique to the Corinthians either. The church in Rome had a similar problem where they had been used to doing this, and Paul had to say, here are the reasons why you shouldn't. And we're not going to look at that today, but it's helpful to know. You can go and look at it later if you want to, and just see how Paul has a very similar message for that church there. At the end of chapter 10, he actually gives a hard no to eating food in the temples. He says, although idols don't mean anything, demons are very real, and if you eat at their table, you're worshipping demons. Don't do that. But it's interesting that he starts his argument not with, it's wrong, don't do it, but he starts his argument with, but what about loving your neighbor? What about loving the other people in your church? It's also interesting that his response isn't, look, here's the line, make sure you stay this side of it. His response is, actually, for some of you, it's okay, and for some of you, it's not okay. And even for the ones who it is okay, sometimes it's okay, and sometimes it's not. It depends who you're with. So it's really interesting that ethics and morality is not about where is the bar and how do I make sure I stay above it. Ethics and morality is all about relationship and love. Those people who are trying to find the bar and stay above it are like the ones who want to know. Paul starts off this point, this passage, by comparing the knowers and the lovers. And he says, knowledge puffs up and love builds up. He says, ethics and morality is not about knowing the right thing to do. It's about loving those around you. The main thing that we can take away is that sometimes ethics is situational. It's not always. There is a hard no to eating in the temple. Some things are black and white. They are, just don't do that. is bad. Sometimes it's situational. It can be to do with your experience. It can be to do with your culture. It can be to do with who's around you. All sorts of things can affect whether something is the right thing to do or not. I think in church we can sometimes be very black and white about things, and we can say, that's clearly bad. Let's not do that. But there really are grey areas where you have to work out what's the loving thing to do, which is more important than what's the right thing to do, or that they are the same thing, really. The right thing to do is the loving thing to do. It feels quite a modern argument to say that what's right for you may not be what's right for them. That morality is relative in that respect. We like to think that, no, God sets the standard for what's right and wrong. So there is absolute right and wrong, and we all just need to find out what it is and live according to it. And the message out there in the world is, no, it's right for you, but it's wrong for me. If it's right for me, you can't judge me. And Paul seems to actually agree with that. He seems to be saying, yeah, that's all right. It's right for them, and it's not right for you. So it's a matter of conscience. It's between you and God. You work it out for yourselves. But what's completely countercultural, even in that, is once you've worked out that it's right for you, even if it's not right for them, you still choose not to do it. That's a really countercultural message, that work out what your rights are, find them, treasure them, but then lay them down for the sake of love of others. We can go on to that knowing and loving slide. We've looked at the very specific situation, and Paul starts off with this more general thing about knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And so he's saying you can know all there is to know about demons and idols and all there is to know about food. I mean, Paul completely agrees that food is for the stomach and the stomach's for food. Yeah. Eating the right things won't bring us closer to God, nor will it take us further away from God. It's not about what you eat, but knowledge, if you just take that and feed on it and know what the right thing is to do, you can really make yourself feel big and important through knowing all the right things. It makes me feel puffed up. I have all the answers. Whereas love, even with knowledge, deflates yourself again, constantly brings humility and builds the other up. And it's not just making them feel built up, but love actually builds up the other person. This is not just a passing thought for Paul, because it comes back a few chapters later. I don't know if you can finish this verse. It's the famous kind of classic wedding passage. Love is patient, love is kind. Love does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. That's it. It's the same word. Love is not puffed up. Right? This is an actual complete binary thing for Paul. Love versus pride and knowledge and being puffed up. It means you should watch out for the person who says, I know what this really says. I know what this really means. I've got the secret knowledge, and I'm willing to share it with you. The person who says that, for them, clearly, knowledge is not about loving one another. That knowledge is about making themselves feel important and showing off. There's this excellent quote from Gordon Fee, which I've read, which once one's theology is properly in hand, once you've worked out what the Bible is all about, it is especially tempting to use it as a club on other people. And we can probably all think of scenarios where we've seen that in action, where people have gone, oh, I've read the Bible, I know what it says, now I'm going to beat you with it because you're not doing the right thing. Recognizing your strength, your power, and your rights, because you have Christ in your life who empowers you to do all things, and then laying down that strength, laying down your rights, is really what the Christian life is all about. It is lived out in generosity towards others, in seeing all that you've been given and choosing to love others with that. I think we have another slide which has that on. Yeah, the Christian life. To recognize all you have in Christ and to lay it down for the love of God and one another. Idol food may not be a particularly relevant example, but if I can pick on a few maybe modern contemporary issues that where this does come up, alcohol is one, and there will be many people in this room for who they think alcohol is fine to drink. I should be careful who I drink around, though, because of the logic that we've seen in this passage, because it may not be loving to the person next to me. There will be other people who see this passage and others in the Bible and think, I'm not going to drink alcohol at all because I see the danger that it poses. And both of those are completely correct and valid conclusions to come to. It's an issue of conscience. It will often come down to your own experience, those who you have close relationship with, cultural ties. There may be subcultures within this country. We absolutely see alcohol linked to violence, linked to other things. And so just avoiding alcohol together is a really, really sensible decision to make. But whether you choose to be careful who you drink around or whether you choose just to not drink at all, both of those are very valid and good decisions. You should be clear in your own conscience on what you think the right thing is to do. But you should be really, really alert to the conscience of those around you and be prepared to lay down alcohol, which, I mean, next to having Jesus, alcohol seems like a small thing, doesn't it? But be prepared to lay down that for the sake of loving others around you. Another example maybe might be your choice of what you watch on TV. So a decade ago, when Game of Thrones was first out, it felt like everyone was talking about it. So I watched the first series and then went, this is really bad for my mind. And so I stopped watching it. But I've been around conversations where people continue to talk about it. And when it's non-Christians, that's one thing. But when it's Christians talking about things that I've decided not to watch, it can make me go, ah, oh, maybe it wasn't as bad as I remember. Maybe it is okay. But I have to remember that even if it is okay for them, it wasn't okay for me. And so as the person who is in the weak category, as Paul would call it, the one who doesn't have the choice whether I'm going to watch it or not, I think that's his use of strong and weak here. The strong person can choose whether to watch it or not. The weak person has no choice because they need to not watch it. I need to speak up and say to those people, actually, I've decided not to watch that. I don't think it's good for me. And then they know to be careful how they speak around me. There is a spectrum, right, of things that are on TV, and everyone's going to draw the line at different places for where it's helpful for them. And that is, again, it's a matter of conscience. It depends on your experience. It depends on all sorts of factors around you. But we should always be prepared to lay down anything, even if you draw the line here and you think all these things are fine, we'd lay them all down for the sake of loving others. There are many other examples I could give. Crossing the road. Am I going to go when there's a red man? We're legally allowed to, right? It's my rights. But if there's a child next to me learning to cross the road, the loving thing to do is to lay down my right to cross the road whenever I want to, for the sake of loving someone else. Swearing or watching TV with swearing. I might know that that's wrong, and I can watch TV and know that that's wrong, but who am I going to watch it with? Betting or gambling. It's clearly very unhealthy for some people, and so we should all not do it, maybe. Or where does a school raffle come into that? And there's a line, isn't there, somewhere. You've got to find the line. But if it's unhelpful for someone else, we can lay down even the things that we've decided are okay for us to do. Buying luxuries. At what point does that become unhelpful? What clothes do we wear? At what point is it unhelpful for someone else? And even though I know it's okay to wear the things that I want to wear, I will lay down my right to wear whatever I want to wear because I know it's going to be unhelpful for someone else. And isn't this just Jesus' entire life? God created the entire world. He could have created it exactly how he wanted to. And when humans didn't do what he wanted them to do, he could have made the world perfect by himself. But he laid down his right to do that because of love. And we see that pretty much every story in the Bible where humans do the wrong thing, but God continually empties himself, lays down his right to do things his own way because he chooses to partner with humans. Jesus was, I'm sure, pretty comfortable ruling at the right hand of the Father, but he gave up what it means to take on humanity so that he could love us. He was constantly misunderstood, constantly abused and heckled and physically, violently attacked. And yet, at any moment, he could have changed that situation. But for the love of humanity, he didn't. He was tempted in the desert, and the devil said to him, "Won't you throw yourself off this high building and the angels will catch you?" And that's not a particular temptation I can say I've ever faced, but it must have been so tempting for God to say, "Yeah, Jesus, these angels will attend to me. These angels, it's your right to command these angels to do whatever you want." But Jesus' response was, "Do not tempt the Lord your God." He was willing to lay down everything that he was entitled to. He could have spent his time going around every town that he preached in. His reputation was such that he could have gone to the ruler of that town and had an audience with them straight away. But he always went to the home of the outcast, the home of the poor, the home of the misunderstood, the home of the sinner, not to condone their behavior, but to choose to lower himself in order to love them. It can feel like a small thing when we consider what is the right thing to do and then to give that up. But that is what the Christian life is in terms of being Christ-like, in terms of drawing others into the love of God. It's being willing to lay down everything that God has given us for the sake of loving those around us. And eventually, of course, he laid down his very life itself. He, above all people, is entitled to live, surely. But he was willing to lay down even that for the sake of loving those around him. And your theology and what you think about right and wrong, your ethics, is not something that lives up here or even in here. It lives in our actions. It lives in what we do and what we say. People see what you do, and they hear what you say, and that's what people see as they want to know what you're like. It's a lived thing, and so it has to be so aware of those around you. It is an embodied thing. It is situational. It is grounded in where you're at, and so we always have to be just prepare to lay down everything we have. Idol food was clearly a big issue. But Paul says he's prepared to never eat meat again if that's what it takes. We have one last slide. I think it's got a Philippians passage on it. I think this sums it up for Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant and being made in human likeness. Jesus was prepared to lay everything down, even though he was God himself. And so there's a moment, isn't there, just to stop and reflect. I wonder if, Rob, you come back up and give us some music just while we just while we reflect. Is there anything that you've been doing in your life generally, habits that you have, where you know your conscience is clear, this is absolutely fine, but have I not been loving others by exercising my rights? It's a very specific question, but this is the one that the passage asks of us. And then more broadly, is there anything that I'm holding on to that I know I'm not prepared to lay down for God? Is there anything that I put above my relationship with God? I'll just pray for us, and then we'll stand and we'll sing together again. But you just want to hold out your hands. God, we just want to ask that you put your finger on things where we have not loved others as we should. Even where we know our consciences are clear, where we've relied on our knowledge and puffed ourselves up rather than loving others. We just want to commit to laying down anything that we need to lay down for the sake of loving others and loving you. We want to be more Christ-like. We want to reflect you to the world. We want to glorify you. And the good news is that there is no condemnation, no guilt, no shame. We are on a journey. God is transforming us through his grace to be more like him. And so it is a gift when God identifies something like that for us. We can grow. We can become more Christ-like. We can glorify him more. We can remember all that God has laid down for us, all that Jesus has sacrificed for us. Allow that grace and the Spirit of God to motivate us to lay down more. Guilt and shame are powerful motivators, but ultimately they won't transform us. Love and the Spirit of God are what we need. And so as we sing, we're going to just enjoy remembering all that God has laid down for us. Commit again to laying down things for the sake of others around us.